trend here that is, one photon per second at, we'll say, 10 gigahertz. Could you receive that signal above threshold? And depending on whether or not you're using the right kind of equipment, we think the answer is yes. We think there is no limit as to how weak the signal can be. You may have to integrate for a very long period of time. You may have to use an extremely narrow bandwidth to receive that signal. In the case of Voyager, you don't have to worry about frequency accuracy. Let me drop. Under normal circumstances, you'd worry about the crystal that's doing the transmitting on Voyager. Is it drifting because of aging? Is it drifting because of temperature? Is it drifting because of voltage variation? Is it drifting? And because they're using a receiver that has approximately 150 hertz of bandwidth to listen to that signal, and the signal is at 8,500 megahertz, and you've got to get that accuracy to the nearest, let me pick a number, 50 hertz. You've got 50 hertz of accuracy out of 8,500 megahertz. In parts per million, it's really a tough job. If you had to make a crystal that accurate to operate 37 years later in the environment of space that that spacecraft has gone through, I'm pretty sure you couldn't achieve it. And the magic of that deep space network, let me drop, is that the accuracy of the signal transmitted by Voyager is identical to the accuracy of the signal you send to it. It uses your signal in a divide and multiply scheme, 240 over 221 is the ratio, and it sends your signal back to you slightly shifted in frequency. So its accuracy is as good as your accuracy on the ground. Therefore, you know exactly what frequency you're going to get back. And you could, if you want to, count every single cycle that comes back down. And at that frequency, each cycle, each wavelength is about an inch. In theory, you have an inch of range resolution when listening to Voyager. If it speeded up or slowed down a little bit and you measure the Doppler shift, you have inch of accuracy resolution because that's the wavelength that's being transmitted. And the signals coming down are exact number of cycles of what you sent up to it. Very well-designed system, that deep space network, the way that thing works, that transponder. Very cute. So it takes your signal, divides it by 240 and multiplies by 121 and sends it back to you. That's the reason why when I was listening to the Apollo astronauts on Apollo 15 and 16, the uplink frequency was 2106.4, downlink frequency is 2287.5. That exact ratio, 240 over 221. Since I knew what frequency was coming back down and I was listening to it, one day I listened to the uplink frequency, to which you would say, why did you do that? Let me drop. I knew that this great big 240-foot diameter dish at Goldstone, California, transmitting 10 kilowatts of power, of FM modulated signal, phase modulated signal, during the time the spacecraft, the orbiter was going around the moon, and during the time the spacecraft was directly in front of the moon, 99.99% of the signal from Goldstone was missing the spacecraft and hitting the moon. So therefore I was listening to the uplink by way of moon echo, and I could hear the audio of what NASA was saying to the astronauts by listening to the moon-bounce echo. Eventually, I decided I didn't even have to do that because the spacecraft itself, because of the way it was designed, a little bit of the uplink signal was being leaked back down into the downlink. And so by way of a kind of leakage, I could decide which one I wanted to listen to. Listen to the leakage of the uplink signal in the downlink transmission or listen to the downlink of the astronaut audio. And there were times when we listened to both. We were hearing both sides of the conversation. Interesting stuff. During the time, they were not connected to the networks. And I can remember the time when NASA was reading up to the astronauts. Let me drop. Giving them the news of what was going on in the Earth, what wars we were fighting, how well we were doing. The astronauts made no comment on any of that. Until they got down to the section of the news where they were announcing the scores of the Houston Astros, the baseball team. I think it's baseball team. And then they let up a cheer, let out a cheer. That was interesting to the astronauts. But what was happening in the rest of the world, that was really outside of their area of expertise, outside of their area of interest. They had just spent the last couple of years, day in and day out, practicing everything they were going to do during that space flight. So they were really disconnected from the world from one point of view, if you know what I mean. Hey, with any further questions or comments on all of the above, give me a call, let us right now. K2LIW in the TechNet. YDY? N1YDY. K2LIW. Go ahead, Hank.
I have a, well, I hope it's a quick question, but I know you say once the signal has emitted, it goes to every corner of the universe, just at a diminished strength based on the distance. The question I have is, I unfortunately have a router that is a wireless router that is in the same room as an antenna that I would like to use for 2 meter, and I am trying to avoid the intermob or whatever the interference I get from that. Is there an easy way, other than physically moving the antenna away from the transmitter, to avoid that?
Is your router that you're talking about, I see I'm putting out some this. Is your router a wired network, or is it running on 802.11, 2.4 gigs? Give me a first a clue on that one. Hank, go ahead.
No, it's 802.11, and the wired part goes from the cable modem goes directly to the computer that when you turn off the router, that continues to work. Of course, I have no interference with the 2-meter radio at that time, but when the wireless router is plugged in, even if no one's using it, it creates some interference for the 2-meter.
Yeah, let me find out who's interfering with who. Is the router making noise that disturbs the sensitivity of your 2-meter reception? Or conversely, when you transmit on 2 meters, does the router lose sensitivity on its 802.11 reception? Or maybe it's both. Who's interfering with who first? Go ahead, Hank.
I'm not sure if the 2-meter rig is interfering with the router, but I am sure that the router will break the spokes of the 2-meter rig, even if the spokes are turned all the way up, preventing me from leaving the rig on when I'm not communicating. I'd like to leave it on with the squelch turned up, so if somebody makes the call, I'm able to walk over and use it. But unfortunately, the router breaks the squelch too often and just causes me to turn the radio off during the day.
Understand. So it does sound like the router is putting out noise on the 146 meg frequency region, even though it really is trying to communicate on 2.4 gigahertz. And I can think about two or three different solutions here. If this is the best of all worlds, the 2.4 gigs antenna and the circuitry on your router would have a bandpass filter that passes nothing but 2.4. I had a similar problem in my house where a piece of equipment running on 2.4 gigs was creating a lot of desensitization to a piece of equipment running on 450 megahertz. And by way of eBay, I think I paid about $10 for it, if I remember correctly, I bought this bandpass filter. The assembly was about 2.5 or 3 inches wide, about 3 inches long, about 1.5 inches wide, and about 1/2 inch thick, with BNC connectors on it. That bandpass filter had a pass band from something like 2.1 to 2.4 gigahertz, or 2.2 to 2.4, it covered the 802.11 frequency region with rather sharp skirts on the side. Once I put that bandpass filter between the 802.11 piece of equipment and its antenna, the interference on 450 disappeared. So a bandpass filter is one solution. Another solution would be to realize that it's an orientation problem. The signal being emitted on 2.4 gigs, which has got some 146 46 megs in there, probably has a particular pattern that by changing the orientation of antennas, you're going to get some number of decibels of suppression.
Repeater, timeout.
So, inverse square law of distance will help, orientation will help, bandpass filtering will help. So, every where your frequencies are so far separated, they're separated by a 20 to 1 frequency region. Let's see, 10 times 144, would it be 140? Yeah, almost a 20 to 1 frequency ratio. Bandpass filtering is an easy approach. And do you need a bandpass filter on both ends? Is an interesting question. So every case of interference can be solved by filtering, shielding, orientation, distance. There's a whole, and you have to also worry about the router. Even if you put the bandpass filter to the antenna, and I think there's a high probability that the majority of the offending signal out of the router on 146 megs is coming out of its antenna. There's a slim possibility, let me drop this. Slim possibility that some of the signal is coming out of the B-plus wiring, the power supply wiring, the Ethernet wiring, whatever wiring it's got, can also be acting like an antenna. By way of a sniffer network, in other words, when the router is running, you could, in theory, build a small loop on the end of a piece of BNC cabling, plug it into your receiver, the 2-meter receiver, and go sniffing. Hold it near the antenna, hold it near the Ethernet wiring, hold it near the power supply wiring, and find out where is the signal coming from. If this is the best of all worlds, you'd be doing that with a spectrum analyzer, which has a lot more sensitivity for displaying very weak signals. But still, using your handy talkie, you should be able to do that. Even holding the handy talkie near things with its rubber duck. The trouble with the rubber duck is that it's a very broad mechanical receiver. The little loop on the end of a piece of BNC cable allows you to go sniffing and find out exactly where it's coming from. I know the problem is solvable. I didn't say how easy it's going to be, but knowing that every interference problem is solvable should give you the enthusiasm to go give it a try if you care enough about eliminating it. And when you do, tell us what you find and come back and tell us about that, Hank. N1YDY, K2RIW and the Tech Man.
Okay, Dick. Well, I have done some of that already. What I have done is I used a loop on the end of a BNC in the handy talkie, and I sniffed around, and I found that it was, you know, directly out of the antenna for the wireless part of the router. It didn't seem to be out of a wall outlet, out of the modem, any power supply, any of these other things. Unfortunately, the antenna is not removable from the router, so my first thought was to move the antenna to a slightly different location, taking advantage of inverse square law to make it work for me. Because unfortunately, I can't move the router easily, but I certainly could have run the antenna if it was removable to a different location and tried that, and still had, you know, enough coverage with the antenna in the household that everybody was happy. But if it doesn't remove, that's not up. Not an option, perhaps, for replacing the router, which is not something I wanted to do first, and I just wanted to ask if there was something I could do to work around it first. But it sounds like I'm probably in the market for a different router that I can move the antenna from, based on what you've been saying. And that way I could, of course, put a bandpass filter in the transmission line to the antenna.
There are other ways of putting a bandpass filter on the printed circuit board inside the router. Yes, you're going to be making a modification. Sometimes a couple of inductors and capacitors that resonate at 2.4 gigs will give you, let me pick a number, 20 decibels of suppression of 146 megs, and that may do it. So if you're willing to open up the case, I know there's a solution there. And this filter that I described, there may be a way if you can squeeze it into that environment and wire it into the network. So I think filtering is one way you want to consider. Orientation, because you want the router to pick up all signals in the house, it's going to be hard to find an orientation that gives you full performance of the router, and let me drop it. And allows you to walk around the house with a handy talkie without being breaking the squelch. So I wouldn't give up. I guarantee there are ways of filtering. Good that you found that it's coming from the antenna, and therefore that antenna connection on that PC board is something you can operate on, because I'll bet you the screws that open up the case of the router are not that difficult to open up. Is that true, Hank? N1YDY, K2LIW?
While I haven't actually opened up the router, I have looked at it. It sure looks pretty simple to get into, so I can't imagine it would be very difficult to do.
So you do have a bandpass filtering problem. And my guess is they're meeting their specification, which is that undesired signals have to be 60 decibels suppressed. Well, a quarter watt transmitter or whatever it is, 60 decibels suppressed is still 15 dB above threshold to your handy talkie. So you need more decibels of suppression, therefore filtering is what I would recommend. And there's ways you can homebrew that filter, there's ways you can buy that filter and adapt it and put it inside that case. So from what I'm hearing, because I did the filter approach and it worked so well, I think you should consider it. Back to you, Hank, K2LAW.
WS2N, question.
Go ahead, Paul.
I'm wondering how close Hank is to the, you know, the HT to the router. A lot of times my HT has got to be, I don't know, maybe 5 feet away from the router. I've never had a problem with this one anyway. The Belkin I wasn't crazy about. I like the Netgear. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I think he's trying to operate across the room. Is that true, Hank?
I'm about 8 feet, maybe 10 feet, but I'd say 8 feet normally. I have found, you know, if I walk into the next room, like right now, I'm in a room about, well, the next room over, and I'm about 13 feet, 14 feet from that antenna, and at that range, so, you know, I don't have any problem.
Hank, are you talking to us with a handy talkie right now? In which case, you're doing very well.
I am, but I'm on a ground supply, and I've got wire running off to a ground plane antenna that's even further away. So the ground plane antenna is sitting, I'd say another 10 feet further away from the radio than I am.
That explains it. I'm hearing a little bit of hiss in the background from your signal. You're 95% audio and 5% noise. And if you were really using a handy talkie, anybody on the handy talkie slowly moves around a little bit as he talks. And as he walks, you hear the signal picket fencing going up and down, and you have no picket fencing. Now I know why. It's that ground. It's that fixed ground plane that's doing it. Back to you, Hank, K2LIW.
It's just a coat hanger that's been cut up and soldered and screwed onto an SO239. That's the wire leading back to the HT.
Now, can you imagine what would happen if you extend that piece of BNC cable, RG58 light cable, even though it's got some extra loss to it, and you put that coat hanger antenna on the second floor of the house and run the cable down to where you are, or put it onto the chimney of the house? Can you imagine how many 10 or 20 decibels stronger your signal will be on all the repeaters you talk to with that very simple antenna? Altitude makes a huge improvement on VHF. I wonder if that's doable in your case, Hank. N1YDY, K2LIW.
Well, it's sort of doable. Right now I'm on the second floor, as is the antenna. And you know, the original intent when I built the antenna was to put it in the attic. Run some 213 up to it. And the reason that it's not in the attic is I haven't successfully pruned it properly, and I still have relatively high SWR, not enough to cause the auto protect to kick in, but I'm running a little less than 2:1 at this frequency. Also, the house is physically built into a, well, I should say the community is built into a hillside. So where I am, I'm below a berm facing to the west, but facing to the east, and to the north and the east, I've got a fairly nice view because the ground falls away from the house. But actually, to get to the repeater, if I could get up a little bit higher, it would do even better. But I think I'm just probably at the line of sight area. I guess finally, the final thing I would need to do is tell you that I cannot put it outside because I'm in an area with homeowner association regulations that prohibit this kind of stuff. And they've got a couple of condo Nazis that go around with nothing better to do with their time now that they're retired.
A 2-meter ground plane antenna made of the right color, painted, mounted to the chimney or some other place on the roof of that building, could be made eye-wise very invisible. Also, if you do mount it in the attic, and I was considering doing that, putting a hole through the top of a closet in my apartment, going into the attic of the apartment building I was in, that'll give you extra altitude, and it'll be moving you further away from the router, and you may no longer be above threshold for the router, if you know what I mean. So putting that antenna in a better location and camouflaging it, I think it's going to give you even more benefit than the filter, because it'll no longer be close and being hearing the router, and all the repeaters you want to talk to, you'll be louder to them. It'll be a handy thing to do. I wonder if any of that's possible, Hank. K2RIW.
Well, there is probably one thing I could do. There are a cupola with a wind vane mounted on the top of it that's on each of the buildings, and it's between the one that's in our building, between this condo unit that my parents own and the condo unit next to them. And so if I could figure out how to get to it from the roof without being seen or without making a hole, the antenna would fit nicely underneath the wind vane but inside this cupola kind of thing.
Yeah, that cupola would be a beautiful way of hiding that antenna. The BNC cable is black, properly routed across the roof. It'll be almost invisible. And if you do that installation in the dark, no one will see you do it. Is there a way you can get on that roof in the dark, Hank?
I'll have to think about that, Dick. It's not readily apparent to me how to do it. Because on the side where I'd only have to put the ladder up one floor, I'd be visible to all the neighbors. And on the side where I'd have to put the ladder up three floors, I would ladder that tall, and I would be visible to the guys at in the gate for the gated community. So if one of them happened to look up instead of when they normally watch TV, they would certainly see me doing it. And one whitey white.
Yeah, it's a challenge. But I still think that's doable. Hams find ways. And so maybe the attic would be more than adequate. Maybe it doesn't have to be outside. Outside would give you more performance. And so that cupola is a beautiful way of hiding things. Good luck with that project. Anyone else with any further questions or comments on all of the above, give me your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
K1MJM.
CCTOIS, query on a different subject.
Okay, Bill recognized, but K1MJM was first. K1MJM was first. MJM, what is your name, sir? K2RIW. My name is Dick.
Hey, Dick, this is Mike, Kilo 1, Mike Juliet, Mike out of Connecticut. Just a quick comment on that last one. Is the weather vane a real weather vane that rotates, or is it a fixed decorative weather vane, and can it be connected to and tuned?
Probably so. But when he finally tunes his coat hanger ground plane antenna correctly, I think using it painted black, putting it inside the cupola, is going to do the job very nicely. Yeah, you could feed the weather vane, but going through the process of tuning the weather vane means he's spending a lot more time on the roof, and I don't think he wants to do that. When he finally gets on the roof, I think he'd like to install the antenna, only be on site for a short period of time. Without a doubt, you can you can resonate anything in the world. There are law enforcement vehicles where the side view mirror is the stealth antenna, or sometimes the antenna is really a speaker network at the rear window of the law enforcement vehicle. Every piece of sheet metal on an automobile can be made into an antenna. Where the fender meets the body of the car, and you create a slot in that area, you can easily make that into an antenna and fill it up with an insulating material and paint it over. You'll never know it. It's easy to make antennas in sheet metal by thinking in the inverse manner. A dipole antenna, we all know what that looks like. It's a conductor that's in the middle of insulating space. If you do the opposite, you make space conducting, and you make the dipole insulating, you'll get the exact same antenna pattern and gain. You start off with a sheet of metal, and you cut a slot into it that looks exactly the right length for your dipole. And properly feed it, you get the exact same pattern, the exact same gain. So slot antennas are rarely used by amateurs because at first we don't understand how they work. And it's hard to believe they work so well. So any piece of metal, if you're smart enough, can be made into an antenna, because the thing that I say over and over again, let me drop. Now, no matter what frequency you're on, if you want an antenna that can transmit and receive, you resonate first, then it will radiate. With rare exception, all the antennas we use must resonate on that frequency if you want it to radiate well and receive well. Resonate first. And once you know how to build a tuning network, any piece of flat sheet metal, any piece of curved sheet metal, any piece of sheet metal that's long, short, wide, thick, whatever, if you're smart enough, you can find a way of making it resonate on your particular frequency, almost anywhere from DC to light in frequency region. And once it resonates, and once you make an impedance match to that resonator, you've got an antenna. There are 5,000 kinds of antennas. You open up the latest issue of the Antenna Engineering Handbook. It's in its fourth edition by Balakis. Before that, it was Johnson and Jasek and Jasek and Johnson and so on. You open up that book, and you'll see pictures and diagrams and chapters on 5,000 kinds of antennas. The one thing they all have in common is they all resonate, with the exception of rhombic and beverage, which are multiple wavelengths long. But any antennas that are a small number of wavelengths long, they all resonate. Back to you, Mike. K1MJM, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Mountain on YDY.
Mike first. Mike first. Go ahead, Mike.
Oh, no, I'm pretty much done. I just thought it might be a good idea if you could get that in, that weather vane to resonate if it were fixed and not a real functional weather vane. Since it's there, since it's the highest point of the roof, you know, take advantage of it. But that was all my only comment. K1MJM, back over to you, Dick.
Yeah, the one thing that scares me about the weather vane is that it's got a rotary joint so that the weather can move it. And that rotary joint, for all we know, makes a scratchy RF contact as it rotates. So it could be a noisy antenna. Was that Hank that had another question? N1YDY, K2LIW?
Well, the comment was just that the rotor vane is in fact functional, so it does, rotor vane, the wind vane is in fact functional, so it does rotate about the pivot, and I'm sure it would be noisy. His question was if it was simply a decorative item and not functional, then perhaps it wouldn't be a noisy antenna, but as it is, I'm sure it would not make a good antenna. Number one, and number two, speaking of the way you were talking about car parts, many years ago I had a wife who would not let me put an antenna on a small Honda CRX that we had, which had plastic front fenders, and I was able to get on 10 meters by making a dipole that was wire that was taped to the inside of the plastic fenders on either side, so it was completely invisible, and the left fender was one side, the right fender was the other, and one whitey white.
Very crafty. Reminds me of the early days of ham radio, where the ham was relegated to the attic of a house, and a wooden house, and what many a ham did is built himself, let's say, an 80-meter dipole, 132 feet long, 67 feet on each side. He ran a 67-foot wire out the eastern window of the attic, another 67-foot wire out the western window of the attic. In the middle of the attic was a wooden table with a transmitter and no transmission line at all. So the transmitter was right in the middle of the dipole. Worked like a charm. Bill, I think you said you wanted to open up a subject on another, open up a question on another subject. AC2IS, question mark, K2LIW, the TechNet.
Yeah, Dick, thanks. This is AC2IS, and I had some questions about super heterodyning. So in a super heterodyne mixer, it's said that the output is your local oscillator, or your frequency you want to tune minus your local oscillator, I believe, and then also you get the combined frequencies added together. I understand the difference coming from an interference pattern between the two frequencies beating against each other, but why would you get both? And then I've got a follow-up question about IQ signals and an assumption I've got in my head that there's a separate local oscillator involved in order to get you the IQ signal output, AC2IS.
Whenever you're using the best kind of mixer I know of, a doubly balanced mixer, you're almost always putting a local oscillator into the so-called LO port, your RF signal into the RF port, if it's a receiver, and out of the IF port, always there are, in general, two signals, sum and difference. In other words, just to give an example, if the local oscillator was on 100 megahertz, and the RF signal was on 110 megahertz, coming out of the IF port would be the difference, 10 megs, and if the IF port has enough bandwidth to it, would also be the sum of the two, 210 megs. So 110 plus 100 is going to give you 210 as well as 10. Sum and difference. You always have both sides. If you study what's going on with the nonlinearity of the mixer diodes inside of a doubly balanced mixer, you'll soon realize why it's got to do that. Let me drop. Conversely, if I feed the doubly balanced mixer backwards, because I'm using it as a transmitter, and in my example, I have a local oscillator at 100 megs, and in the IF part, I put in a signal that's got my information on it of 10 megs, what will come out of the RF port is again sum and difference, but in this case, the sum and difference is going to be 10 megs added and 10 megs subtracted from the 100. Therefore, the output signals will be on 110 and 90 in this example. And if the doubly balanced mixer has real good isolation, there'll be almost no 100 coming out. There'll be almost no 10 coming out. Only sum and difference will come out of that transmitter. Now, the way you build an INQ demodulator, let me drop, is you take the signal of interest, whether it be an RF signal or an IF signal that's already been through a super het front end of the first stage of mixing down to an IF. You take the signal of interest, IF. Let's assume your IF is at 1 megacycle. And now, if you put that into a pair of doubly balanced mixers, you take the IF signal into a power divider. So now the IF signal, in my example of 1 megahertz, is going down 2 paths. And each one of those paths goes into a doubly balanced mixer. And the doubly balanced mixer, in my example, if the doubly balanced mixer had a local oscillator of exactly 1 megahertz, but the two different mixers have got local oscillator, both exactly 1 megacycle, in my example, but the two local oscillators are in quadrature. One local oscillator is 90 degrees ahead or behind in phase compared to the other. So You got these two signals in quadrature, local oscillator signals, going into two separate mixers, and the two IFs, also at 1 meg in my example, are going into the RF port of the two mixers. What comes out of the IF port will be I and Q, because the local oscillator was offset by 90 degrees. The mathematics of how that works, a little bit complicated. And the example I gave of the local oscillator equaling the IF frequency is not the only way to do it, but it's the most convenient way. That's the so-called zero IF system. I and Q demodulator, they call it zero IF. The second IF in that example of those two mixers is called the zero
repeater. Timeout.
The second IF I gave in that example is the so-called zero IF system. And there's a lot of advantage to having an I and a Q signal. Let me drop. And that is to fully reconstruct a signal. You need I and Q. And once you've got I and Q, you now have the ability to use what's called image phasing mixer. In the earlier example I gave of 100 meg LO and a 10 meg of signal, and therefore you go to the mixer and out comes some indifference, 110 and 90. If you've got an I and Q system, which is what's really going on inside of a image phasing mixer, of the two possible output signals of 110 or 90, you can choose which one you want and suppress the other one by 30, 40, 50 dB with an image phasing mixer, as long as you have I and Q components of your signal. So I and Q in phase and quadrature, so-called vector demodulator or vector modulator, gives you a huge advantage in integrity of signal, filtering of signal, no filtering required, gives you a huge advantage if you know what you're doing. But it takes a little bit of extra study. AC2IS, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Thanks for that, Dick. AC2IS here, and I'm wondering if you're describing a two-stage super heterodyne where there's super heterodyning or heterodyning going on twice, once for each stage. Why would you not have the second quadrature local oscillator on the first stage? Why would you bother with the second stage? That's not clear to me. It seems to me that if you have an image problem in the first stage, you're not going to be able to undo that image problem in the second stage. You'd just be sort of solving an image problem that might be created in the second stage. Am I getting that right or wrong? And also, I'm still not sure why a mixer produces the sum of the two frequencies. I don't understand the physics behind that. AC2IS.
In theory, on paper, you could do what you desire. In the example I gave of where the signal is 110 megs, and you have a local oscillator in your superheterodyne front end of 100 megs, the first IF would be at 10 megs. That's the difference. And coming out of that mixer would be the two signals, 10 megs and 210 megs. The 210 megs is so far away from the 10 megs for you to filter that you only pass the 10 and reject the 210, very easy filtering. So when it comes to some indifference coming out of the first mixer, rejecting the undesired one in many cases is very easy. Now, there's one other thing I should tell you. When you're receiving 110 with an local oscillator of 100, you'll get an IF of 10. Unfortunately, if you don't have good RF filtering, and there's another undesired signal at 90 mixing with an LO of 100 will also give you an IF of 10. So that particular receiver will have two different places where it's listening, so to speak. And so unless your RF filter passes 110 and rejects the 90, you will have an image problem. So a dual conversion superhet system, let me drop. A dual conversion superhet system is very desirable. because once you study the usual good design practices for a superhead, in general, each IF stage is roughly 10% of the frequency of the RF. In the case of the example I just gave, 110 or 90 megs coming in, mixing with an LO of 100, gives you an IF of 10. There is a 10 to 1 ratio there. And in the case of the 10 to 1 ratio, for you to put an RF filter that passes 110, the desired signal, and rejects the 90, the undesired signal, to make an RF filter do that, pretty easy. Then the next stage of conversion, and your dual conversion superhead, you take the 10 megs and convert down to 1 meg. Again, the 10 to 1 ratio. And the filtering becomes very easy. If you try to combine that, and you jump down to 1 meg directly, you're listening to 110, and now you mix it with a signal of 109, 1 meg away. You'll still get an IF of 1 meg, and you've eliminated one of the stages, you think. However, that receiver will be sensitive to not only 110 with an LO of 109, but it'll also be sensitive to a receiver of 108. Now to make your RF amplifier have enough selectivity to pass 110 but reject 108, that's a lot more difficult. Now you see why you usually have a 10 to 1 ratio, so that you're really getting to a lower frequency. Let me drop. Your IF is at a much lower frequency. It's much easier to get gain, much easier to get bandpass filtering at the lower frequency. But you want the ratio to be like 10 to 1 so that the RF filtering to get rid of the image is easier to do. So that's one reason why you would use dual conversion. A second reason why you do dual conversion is that to really get a clean I and Q signal, that second set of mixing that I described with power divider, two separate mixers, LO, same frequency going into both mixers, but one is 90 degrees different than the other, you want that system to be zero IF. If your LO, if your IF signal was at 1 meg, and your LO is at 1 meg into each mixer, but they're in quadrature, to make 1 megacycle equal the frequency of the IF, it's easy. To do that at 110 megs, directly into I and Q, where now you want the LO to be 110, to get enough accuracy on that one, see, that creating a beat note, so to speak, much more difficult. So many of these zero IF systems are really a dual conversion or a triple conversion superhead for that I and Q output. The one exception to that, let me drop. The one exception to that is the RFID radio frequency identification reader or interrogator. Because the local oscillator that's being re-radiated by the tag is coming from your transmitter, in that particular case, zero IF is easy. If you're listening to a tag at 915 megs, and you're transmitting a signal to it at 915 megs, and your receiver uses a local oscillator at 915 megs, two separate local oscillators, 90 degrees apart, into two separate mixers, in that case, the frequency error will never be there, because the tag is only reproducing the signal that you transmitted to it. Therefore, you've got complete control of the transmitting frequency, complete control of the receiving frequency, complete control of the local oscillator into your mixers, because all of that is inside of your interrogator. So in that particular case, you can jump directly down to the zero IF because there is no frequency error, because you've got complete control. That's a very rare situation. AC2IS, KQRIW in the TechNet.
Okay, AC2IS here. Thanks, Dick. I think I'm understanding a lot more or a lot better, at least one of those two. But I'm still weak on the physics behind how it is two frequencies get added together in a mixer. I understand the difference that you get from an interference pattern, the two frequencies beating against each other. I do
that the Burns single sideband transmitter, Burns is a very good company that makes single sideband transmitters, and the chief engineer, Bill, has the single sideband transmitter, which he claims is very linear. And Dick comes along and says, okay, hey Bill, I'm going to check the linearity of your transmitter. I'm going to do it by a two-tone test. I'm going to put into the microphone two separate tones. One of them is 1 kilohertz, and the other one is 1.5 kilohertz, so to speak. And now I'm going to look at the output on a spectrum analyzer. And if your single sideband transmitter is really linear, I'll see two tones in the output. Let's assume now that it's a 100 megacycle transmitter. I'm whistling into that microphone. I've got two precise oscillators at 1 kilohertz and 1.5 kilohertz. Therefore, what comes out is 100 megs plus 1 kilohertz. And the second signal coming out is a 100 megs plus 1.5 kilohertz. On the spectrum analyzer, I will see two tones, exactly the same spacing as the two audio tones that went into the microphone circuit. And if your transmitter is thoroughly linear, no other signals will be there in that output. Let me drop. But now let's get real. Every single sideband transmitter has a degree of nonlinearity, whether it be flat topping, whether it be crossover distortion, whether it be phase shift versus amplitude. It's got some degree of nonlinearity, and there's a zillion ways it can have nonlinearity. No matter what the nonlinearity is, I look at that spectrum analyzer of those two tones coming out, and I will see a Christmas tree. I'll see the two tones as the main signals, and then 30 dB down, I'll see another pair of tones with the exact same spacing, one above the highest and one below the lowest with the exact same spacing. Those are the third order intermods. They're 30 dB down. And then 45 dB down, I'll see the fifth order intermods. Twice the spacing above the strong signal, the highest strong signal, and twice the spacing below the lowest signal. I'll see those other tones. Whenever any nonlinearity takes place, whatever the combination of the two signals you put through the system, it will generate other signals. If you really study what two tones look like, if I have an audio oscillator at 1 kilohertz and a second audio oscillator at 1.5 kilohertz, the separation between those two, let me drop, is 0.5 kilohertz. If I look at that on a oscilloscope, those two signals simultaneously generated and thoroughly linearly mixed to each other. That's another whole trick. The way you generate those two signals to test a single sideband transmitter, that itself is an art form, because you want to make sure that your dual signal generator of the 1 and the 1.5 kilohertz signals, audio signals in my case, you've got to make sure that they are being generated in a thoroughly linear manner and not mixing with each other. In other words, you've got one oscillator at 1 kilohertz and you want none of that signal to get into the 1.5 kilohertz oscillator, because you'll start getting some funny effects if they get mixed. So you have to use some kind of a hybrid-like device that takes those two separate oscillators, mixes them together in a thoroughly isolated manner from each other before they come out of the sum port. So if you look at those two signals on a oscilloscope, you'll see a very peculiar waveform when you synchronize the oscilloscope the right way. It's a double butterfly-like signal, which has got a kind of crossover to it, where instantaneously, in my example, I think at a 1.5, at a 0.5 kilohertz rate, which is the difference between the two signals will instantaneously go through zero, where each one of the signals has a slope of 45 degrees as it goes through zero. It's a very sharp zero of that combined signal, properly viewed on an oscilloscope. And so therefore, as far as the amplifier is concerned, that's in your transmitter, let me drop it. The audio system is going to have, let me pick an example, 3 kilohertz of audio bandwidth. The audio amplifier that's 3 kilohertz wide, connected to your microphone, doesn't know there are two signals there, 1 kilohertz and 1.5 kilohertz. In my example, it doesn't know there are two signals. All it knows is there's this very complicated composite waveform of those two signals added together. Therefore, it's got this very difficult job of amplifying a signal that periodically goes to twice voltage and periodically goes to absolute zero voltage, which means the total dynamic range of the system is going from no signal, and I mean no signal, infinite dB down, to full blast signal, twice the voltage of any one signal, and is doing that periodically at a 0.5 kilohertz rate. It's an extremely severe test. It's the equivalent of taking the amplitude control of one signal generator and slowly rotating the dial, the amplitude dial, from minus infinity in dB all the way up to plus 6 dB in infinity, in amplitude, and looking for perfect linearity all the way. That would be a very difficult test. But putting in a pair of tones forces that test to take place dynamically. It's a very simple looking test, but it's a very severe test of linearity. Any nonlinearity will produce all possible M by N products. The third order intermod really means, let me drop,
is the WQVL amateur radio repeater system.
It's called third order intermod because any nonlinearity means that you're making the second harmonic of one signal, mixing it with the fundamental of the other. That upper side lobe is 2F2 plus F1. Minus F1. The lower side lobe is 2F1 minus F2. Because you're taking the second harmonic of one, mixing it with the fundamental of the other, 2 plus 1 is 3. That's part of the reason why they call it third order intermod distortion. The signal that's twice the spacing away is the third harmonic of one minus the second harmonic of the other. Any nonlinearity means you're going to be generating harmonics. And when you mix them together, you're going to get all possible combinations of sum and difference. Mixers do that. Why they do that, that in itself is one hell of a question, Bill. Hope you're not asking that one. AC2IS, K2LIW, the TechNet.
Okay, AC2IS here. So to oversimplify your answer, it's harmonic effects. And then I guess I have one more question. Hopefully this is a quick one. The mixer, I believe, is essentially could be implemented with a sort of a single tube or a single transistor, effectively multiplying instantaneous voltage over time. Does that sound correct? AC2IS.
On paper, the answer is yes. With modern-day circuits, you will never do it that way, Bill. With modern-day circuits, because it is so simple, because you get such a huge advantage by building what's called a doubly balanced mixer, in my opinion, with exception of you trying to build a 30-cent circuit in order to make a great big production run and make a whole lot of profit and don't give a darn about quality, you will never use a single-ended mixer in the rest of your life unless you're forced to, if you know what I mean. There's so many disadvantages of a single-ended mixer that you just described. You're going to be using a doubly balanced mixer. You Google the word doubly balanced mixer. Let me drop. Google those words, doubly balanced mixer. Look at that schematic diagram. Look at the various articles that explain how it works. You'll soon realize that the magic of a doubly balanced mixer is that you're putting a local oscillator of a whole lot of power into the LO port, and it doesn't come out any other port. It's thoroughly isolated. You can put an RF signal into the RF port of any amplitude you like. It doesn't come out of any other port. Those two ports are thoroughly isolated from each other on a properly operated doubly balanced mixer. That's a very ideal characteristic. The so-called single balanced mixer that you just described, you're going to have a whole lot of local oscillator coming out. In my example of signal at 110 and LO of 100, in the case of a singly balanced mixer, you're going to have the 100 LO coming out the IF port, the 110 RF coming out the IF port, the difference between the two of 10 megs coming out of the IF port, the sum of the two of 210. You're going to have four signals coming out of that IF port because of a lack of isolation of a singly balanced mixer. Living with a single balanced mixer is a hell of a lot more difficult. It costs you an extra 50 cents worth of hardware to make a doubly balanced mixer. And of the four signals that can potentially come out, two of them just got isolated because you're choosing a doubly balanced mixer. It gives you a huge leg up of making a good receiver. Every mixer you use from now on, you have the resources, you have the dollars to buy a doubly balanced mixer. Don't use anything else, in my opinion, Bill. AC2IS, K2RI, the
repeater, timeout.
Last transmission was coming up, but I got it all, I think. AC2IS here, so, okay, I'll make a note to spring for the second transistor if I'm ever building a mixer, but I guess the simple part of the question is, it is intended to multiply the two signal inputs, is that correct? AC2IS.
There's a sort of yes and a no to when you use the word multiply. And by the way, you don't do it with two transistors. You do it with four diodes. Every well-made doubly balanced mixer has four diodes in a ring and two separate transformers, miniature RF transformers. One coupling the LO, one coupling the RF, and there's a set of tap on at least one of those transformers. So, a good doubly balanced mixer consists of four diodes. You're not going to be doing it with two transistors. You could do it with four transistors, and I don't recommend it. Once you see the schematic diagram of doubly balanced mixer, you'll discover something very interesting. Let me drop it. In my particular example of local oscillator at 100 and RF at 110, the local oscillator is going to be by far the strongest signal. When you're doing it correctly, the local oscillator is always 10 dB stronger than the strongest RF signal you ever intend to use. Violate that law and the doubly balanced mixer starts behaving in ways that you don't like. Make sure the LO is always 10 dB stronger. That's test number one. What you suddenly also realize is that the local oscillator is, when it goes into that diode network of four diodes in the doubly balanced mixer, you could say it gets converted into a perfect square wave. The perfect square wave means that the RF signal is being coupled to the IF port, but it's flipping back and forth in polarity. In my example, with the LO at 100 megs, make believe that with a 100 megacycle square wave, when the square wave is positive, the RF is fed through directly. When the square wave of the LO is negative, the RF is being fed through inverted in polarity. So the RF is being fed through inversing in polarity at the local oscillator rate. If you look at it that way, a double pole, double throw switch. It is a kind of a double pole, double throw switch. Let me drop. Which is flipping back and forth in polarity at the local oscillator rate. That's what the four diode doubly balanced mixer is really doing. And now if you study that, there's ways you can make a diagram to show how what comes out is primarily the different signal and almost everything else is suppressed. You get a huge advantage in doing that. There's a lot more to it. But you Google those words, study those diagrams, read some of the articles, and you're going to say, wow, how have I ever lived without that component? AC2IS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, AC2IS here, and at this point I might have to apologize about monopolizing the airwaves with this conversation here, but really the local oscillator that goes into your mixer is supposed to be a square wave at that point?